This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Wolf French.
And what's our topic this week, Wolf?
Culture.
Culture.
Yes.
And like the bacteria.
I knew you were going to go there. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you got to be quick with this. You got to come up with, you got to throw out your first one. When did you come up with? So, to all our listeners, welcome back to what we hope to be regular episodes of Edge Cases, at least for a while. We did a couple episodes in the middle. I had a couple with some friends of mine, some local friends of mine, and then we did our live episode, and that was three episodes total. So even though Wolf gave the last episode, it's now an odd episode again. Mm-hmm. So Wolf is going to give this one so that we can stay on track, so that whenever, for the most part, when you look at odd episodes, you'll know that they're always Wolf and even episodes, and it's always me. That's the thinking behind that.
And as the pun master, you purposely want to make sure I had the odd episodes.
Well, I don't remember us having a big discussion about who would go first.
I think you were playing the long game, and I was swept up in it, and I didn't understand what was going on.
That's right. I said, hey, Wolf, you want to do the first one? Yeah. Of course you do. Alrighty, so I don't think we have any feedback, because we haven't actually talked all that much. Right. So there are a couple of pictures on the Edge Cases show Twitter feed. Some people took pictures for the live show that if you're interested, you should go check those out. And I believe somebody tweeted that, oh my God, I've never seen what you guys look like.
I mean, both our Twitter avatars are not of our faces.
Are not us, yeah, right. So there you go. But I think that's it for me. So, Wolf, why don't you get started?
Okay. So I've long had an interest in kind of programming cultures and kind of the culture of software development. And different disciplines have their own cultures and kind of subcultures and so forth. I don't know if I ever talked about this on this show, but at least the first C4, I talked about what C4 stood for, and I had like people try to guess on what stood for. And
yes, I remember.
Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah, and it stands for Code Culture Conspiracy Conference. And so there's that.
I knew I was never going to remember that.
And it's a lot of it has to do with, because I was, you know, fascinated about the culture behind MacHack and kind of like the intensely technical aspects of it, but the playfulness of it and so forth. It really stood unique. And so when MacHack died, it almost felt like, you know, part of me died. So I wanted to capture at least some of that. And I captured parts of it and kind of built up other areas and didn't do such a good job on some other areas. But, you know, at least that was the thrust of what I was getting at there. So to kind of pave the way here, there's David Foster Wallace is a pretty famous author. I have actually never read any of his books. Maybe now that I have a Kindle and I can just read these e-books, because I always kind of like, maybe, I don't know, it just kind of felt like pompous or something to carry around these huge David Foster Wallace.
Yes, they're
tome.
Gigantic.
Right,
yes,
it's
yes.
Like, yeah, they're also, like, look at me, I'm reading literature. And it's just, it was the signaling was pretty intense for me.
Well, don't get like a Kindle with very little memory, because it might not all fit.
There you go. So I haven't read. I have to, you know, start this off by saying I haven't read any of his books, but I
tried to read Infinite Jest.
Oh yeah, did you do the Infinite Summer thing?
I couldn't do it.
Oh really?
I got like two chapters in. And it was just not for me.
Oh okay, well that's interesting. Maybe so, that's
a little bit of derailing
book.
There. Yeah. Yeah,
but I did read his 2005 Kenyon, who I assume is a college, K-E-N-Y-O-N, so not Kenyon, like Africa Kenyon, but Kenyon commencement. I assume it's that college I haven't heard of either, which is probably just because I'm not good at colleges. It's probably very famous. I just haven't heard of it.
And, I haven't heard of it either.
Okay, well, there we go. That's who I was there. That totally makes it non-famous.
Well, yes.
But so he kicked off his commencement with a little parable that really kind of stuck with me. And so it's a short one, so I'll just kind of quote it here. And I'll also throw a link up in the show notes, because the rest of the commencement speech is definitely worth reading. And it's also fairly short. Okay, so, quote, "There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, 'Morning, boys, how's the water?' As the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over the other and goes, 'What the hell is water?'" So this is pretty much, you know, that we don't notice, we're the fish in the water, and because we're always surrounded by it, we never notice it. And with the, I mean, we're right now we're in an ocean of air, and it's pretty obvious to think of, because as you go up higher, it gets thinner, and we have the entire thing about, you know, as you get lower altitudes, you know, the nitrogen combo, you know, basically kind of rests on itself, so air gets denser as you get deeper. But, you know, because it's around us, we don't even think. We just think we're kind of living in space, which is obviously not the case. But so we have this basically technically, too. And for our purposes tonight, coming from a liberal arts college, I'm big on defining my terms up front. So for our purposes tonight, I'm going to define culture in a very kind of weird way, but specific, because there are much larger issues that obviously people spend their careers and talk about culture and stuff like that, and also philosophical stuff about it. But for our purposes tonight, I'm going to call a culture a set of beliefs and the priorities of what's important. And so I purposely use the word beliefs instead of like assertions or postulates, because I want to include things that are probably not verifiable or testable in any way. This kind of what people think. And so you can think of like tradition as being a set of inherited defaults that when you enter a culture, either being born into it, or which is much more common with technology, is that you choose to enter a culture, a technical culture, where you know, join, you know, maybe you learn Rails, and you fall into not only the Ruby community then, but also kind of the Rails superset of the Ruby community. So it's, you choose to enter one when you basically pick up a technology stack. And these technologies have their own beliefs and trade-offs and the priorities thereof. And these cultures kind of compete amongst each other. So you have kind of the meme and memeplex kind of evolutionary competition thing going on there, but not all the time and not directly. Technology is kind of weird because we kind of find our own niches, and so, yeah, we do have technologies that die out and some that get that boom. Like Objective-C, weirdly enough, had that, you know, it was almost on the brink of dying there, but had that boom phase. But a lot of it is actually kind of indirect and kind of just finding our own niches. And so the first thing that I think will help us kind of frame the discussion is, when you think about culture, is, so why didn't Linux succeed on the desktop? So Andrew, what do you think here?
Well, I mean, do you think that's a cultural issue?
Well, I think it is, but do you think it's something else?
Well, I think it's well, it depends on what you mean by talking about developer culture. That's one thing. I mean, I think it's the non-developers did not adopt it as their own,
mm-hmm,
in a way that they have with other products, although it's also economic issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that there would have had to have been a reason for regular users to use something that was otherwise actually relatively difficult for them to set up and, mm-hmm, and use properly. And there was no killer app,
right,
for it to make them do it. So they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also, and so when you say culture, I mean, people use a lot of things that are not necessarily worth their time or worth the trade-offs. And they do it because everyone else is doing it, because it's, the culture has decided to appropriate that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. I mean, Windows is one example,
right?
You use it because everyone at your office is using it, and there's, you know, there are both technical and social reasons why you would use it. But that also never sprung up, mm-hmm, for Linux, and that might also be because the like the executive level people, the people in charge, the elites, also never really. The power elites never took it on either, as opposed to the technical elites who aren't the ones to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
All that makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be a mistake to say that was any one thing that led to Linux not dominating the desktop. But there are a bunch of facets. I liked your facets. Definitely the network effects of the Microsoft Windows monopoly type thing. That's a big part of it. But it's also like the culture of, you kind of mentioned in the beginning, the culture of the developers of Linux and the distributions of it, they never prioritized user experience, like say Apple developers do, and even Microsoft developers. I know we give them a lot of crap, but they care about user experience also very much as well. Where with Linux, it was always kind of focused more on, this is freedom. This is, you can control everything. You can dial. You know, there are no bottlenecks here. You get to decide on what your computing experience is, and that's very powerful. And one of the things with these cultures that, and I talk about these priorities and the trade offs, that none of them are wrong. There's choices, and for better or for worse, those choices, those priorities that the Linux developers had, that's not what the market wanted. And you know, obviously, I see a bunch of developers still using ThinkPads with Ubuntu on it or whatever. And it's also not black and white. I mean, Linux on the desktop has definitely improved over the years to the point where it's highly usable nowadays. But again, it's in those early days, I guess maybe late 90s, early 2000s, when there was a decided push on there, the culture didn't support it. And even, you know, I'm not saying that even if the culture was fanatical about user experience, again, they had to, there are a bunch of other things working against them. I'm not saying that would have been the slam dunk. But a culture did play an important aspect of why that didn't happen and kind of the failure of that movement. So along the same lines, we have cultures in programming languages. So Perl family famously has the phrase, there's more than one way to do it. And I don't know if you – I was doing some Googling while I was researching all this stuff. And I didn't even know that I knew there was obviously an acronym for it, there's more than one way to do it. But I didn't know there's actually a pronunciation of this. Have you heard this pronunciation, Andrew?
The pronunciation of the acronym of the phrase?
Yes.
No.
Tim Todi. There's
Who's Tim Todi?
Tim Todi is when you take.
Oh, no.
Okay. But apparently, it's this acronym, this phrase, there's more than one way to do it, which eventually I will get out without stumbling over. there's more than one way to say it. It has been extended to, there's more than one way to do it, but sometimes consistency is not a bad thing either. And
that's a little harder to make an acronym out of.
Well, then you'd be surprised, because I also learned from our friend Wikipedia that it is pronounced Tim Todi bicarbonate. So there you go. But anyway, so I remember when I was learning Perl back in, I want to say 1995, something like that. I remember running into the idea, the value of there's more than one way to do it. And it was intriguing to me, and I could see some rationale about it, but I didn't really buy it. And I think Python has this famous PEP 20. PEP stands for Python Enhancement Proposal. So it's kind of like public RFCs for supposedly enhancing Python itself, but the PEP 20 is more kind of like a philosophical one. And one of the items on PEP 20 is which kind of displays kind of the Zen of Python, which I believe is actually the name of PEP 20. Is that there should be one, and preferably only one, obvious way to do it. And so you can see, like, that is, again, a trade-off, right? So Perl, you can be expressive, and you can kind of view it almost Perl like prose, in terms of, you know, there's, like in English, you can write the same sentence in different ways, you know, from kind of a terse kind of just get the facts out to maybe a business casual to a much more poetic type of way. And it's interesting to be able to do that with a language. And as I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Again, it's very interesting. And to a certain extent, it allows you to be more expressive in terms of when you're reading the code, kind of understanding maybe the feeling of the software, of like how, like what the priorities are of the program itself. But that gets really touchy-feely really fast, so I'm not going to go down too far that route. But versus Python's, where they almost took the Perl, there's more than one way to do it, and they flipped it on its head, because they realized that it's better to, at least in their priorities, it's better to try to make things obvious and maybe limit the types of control structures and to focus on the things that are important instead of making it so you can write all these things in different ways. So that's example of two different languages and the cultures behind them and their sets of trade-offs. And I would say, I mean, Perl, it's kind of hard to say that Perl it's kind of like with the Linux on desktop thing. It's, you know, Perl is not in its glory days right now. It's kind of thought of maybe a weird language that no one's really picking up anymore. It's hard to say that to say there's more than one way to do it was a nail in that coffin, but I think it was probably a bad decision overall. And of course, there's kind of the Perl 6 debacle that, you know, is probably a much larger issue here. But I think Python pretty much gets it right, and this is actually an example of kind of cultures competing with each other more directly, because the type of software you can write in Perl is often the kind of software you can write in Python. And I think you could argue that Python had a culture that was more in tune with what the outside world wanted, and people were more willing to kind of sign up for that type of way of looking at things. Along the same lines, Randy Luke, which I actually thought about tweeting at you, Randy, to get the correct pronunciation of your last name, because I guess I never actually said it. But then I realized that'd be a dishonor to you, because it's quite the honorable thing to get your name personally butchered by me. So I decided just to roll with it. And he wrote...
Can people sign up for that? Is that going to be a service?
Mispronunciation is a service.
That's how we'll make money.
Finally, a plan. I like it. He wrote a blog posting a little while back called "I'm Done with the Web," and I'll link to it again for the show notes. And so Randy was involved with the Cappuccino project, which we've talked about on the show before. And he gave up on the web as a platform, and it had to do with the web's culture, the kind of the web app culture, where you have like functional web pages type stuff. And obviously, Cappuccino did not set the world on fire like I wish it had, and for better or for worse. And there's was kind of a thrust in, and maybe this is still going on, I've kind of lost track myself, in the web front-end web developer community for micro-libraries or micro-JS, where the idea is that you are trying to atomize these things to smaller and smaller libraries, and then you can kind of mix and match and kind of build, you know, you only use what you need. And is like even jQuery, the library, it was deemed kind of too big, and there were a bunch of micro libraries doing one little aspect of what jQuery provides. And jQuery actually ended up responding to that kind of directly and kind of made it so you could kind of tick off the features you want and kind of build your own jQuery type stuff. But this type of like the priority there is you could see that there is a priority, a focus on kind of the optimization there. And the optimization of like the site, and part of that has to be do with file size, because obviously we all want our web pages to load very snappily and be as small as it can be. They come up fast. And also there was a different tack there that as native developers, we're probably not nearly as tuned to, that web developers are more attuned to, at least front-end ones, that there is a high priority on ease of getting started. It was prioritized over kind of solving hard problems in a general way. And Randy actually linked to a Hacker News comment on this that was talking about Ember.js, which is far less complicated than Cappuccino, but also gets a lot of the same criticisms for being kind of a larger framework type thing that you have to actually study for a while to figure out. And the quote is that if it's going to take me at least a day or two before I can begin to understand, how long is it going to take the rest of my team? And so that quote kind of indicates a priority of really, like, you know, with micro.js libraries, and I think Randy even called this out, like, if you only need to learn one or two functions to use this micro library. You could do that probably, in your lunch hour. Obviously, you probably do that during real hours, but I mean, it's a much smaller task to pick up these small micro libraries and kind of use them for what you need, and then move on without having to learn kind of like new conceptual ideas of how to organize your software and bigger concepts.
Well, I mean, compare that against the 1,000-page manual of Swift that we got from WWDC.
Yes.
It's a very different mindset to do, you know, no, I don't even want to spend an hour to learn this.
Right.
I don't want to spend a day to learn this. Mm-hmm. That's very unlike the way I think.
Yes. And we're native developers, and we're used to having these pretty big on-ramps to technologies, right?
Actually, a big on-ramp would be easier. You mean a steeper on-ramp, probably.
Okay. I'll go with that pendant. I totally understand Randy's frustration. I have pretty much the same frustration with web developer community. They tend to kind of, it leads to this kind of this behavior where they reinvent the wheel and like reinvent a new widget toolset that doesn't work very well every other week. And
it does seem like they're doing that. I haven't been paying a lot of attention, but there's a lot of those frameworks.
Yeah, and there's a framework de jure type thing going on where Cappuccino was kind of holistic and it had quite a big on ramp and was deemed pretty much too large, and rightfully so for a lot of the stuff is that, you know, it was for building desktop caliber apps in the browser.
It was for making it easier for Cocoa developers to write web apps.
Well, yes, but the nice thing about Cocoa is that it has a robust application architecture there that, not necessarily the best one, but it was one that kind of has stood the test of time, and that was not something that the web really had before. The fact that things like Backbone.js, which I use Backbone, and I like it. It's very kind of primitive type of framework for this type of stuff, and Cappuccino was a much bigger part. It was probably the biggest answer to the problem that I've seen. Ember, I think, is probably a better kind of fit for most people, but there's been a lot of pushback that this is too complicated for me to even want to learn, that they'd rather kind of piece together these micro libraries that are being reinvented every other week. And to me, that's actually the danger of that value system, that set of priorities, that where you have kind of these, you don't ever make progress. You just constantly are polishing and reinventing the lower level components, and you don't ever end up building the bigger stuff.
Well, they're constantly appearing and disappearing out of the foam. They're quantum micro libraries.
There we go. Along those lines, Francisco Tomaski had a blog post about kind of like Cappuccino project, and the sad thing is that that 280 slides was basically keynote for the web, and he pointed out that if it were introduced today, people would it still would be amazing in comparison to web technologies. So it's one of these things where that it solved a bigger problem, and the web culture, the web front end web culture, I would say that its culture is toxic in terms of it moving forward and addressing real issues. We're not going to go with the tax Kelsey thing. while I'm personally upset that, like, I feel that the web was very promising as an application development platform, I'm kind of bemoaning the rise of the mobile apps replacing the web in many respects. And the culture brought on itself. It was not – there's something very arthritic about it where it's not really focusing on the bigger applications, the bigger solutions. And it's kind of looks inside itself too much and kind of gives itself too much credit for reinventing things it already has instead of building larger structures to allow to build better apps. And so in that case, the culture hasn't really aligned too well with what outsiders want and and the web is not competing as well as it really could, which is sad. So further along the cultural lines, of course, we have to come to Apple. And I addressed this in my Singleton talk of last year, Fillers and Spillers. That was Edge Cases 67. I don't remember if I actually talked about my hardware that I was talking about during my actual presentation at Singleton. I don't think I did. But anyway, roughly you can think of the culture of Apple has actually changed over the year from the very open, very hackerish Apple II to the kind of elite closed system of the Macintosh with the Torx screwdrivers to the next very stylish software developer friendly type era. The post-next Apple, where we have basically the iMac era and the iPod era and the iPhone era. And I got the feeling with the last dub that WWDC 2014 that people were basically saying that this is, you know, a new phase in Apple's culture. Its value system, its priorities has changed. It seems to be, I wouldn't say, a lot of people are saying, oh, Apple is so much more open now. I won't go that far. But there is an openness and a silliness to Apple I have not seen in a very long time. I want to say back probably maybe in the 1992 Apple. And in many ways, well, I mean, there's even some aspects of the silliness. Yeah, I would put it about maybe 1992 Apple. And so, but it's interesting because Apple's this, as an organization, I have to give it credit, that this is an organization that survived pretty massive cultural shifts. I mean, the Macintosh, as compared to the Apple II, was pretty, I mean, I'm not going to say it's about face or anything, but there are a lot of values and a lot of priorities that got switched around when the Mac took over as the flagship platform. And we saw a little bit of a repeat of that with the even more closeness of the iPhone. But again, it's Apple seems to be so far doing pretty well. Well, I shouldn't say it's doing so well because we only really experienced this Apple coming out with a new culture for maybe, I guess, 2 weeks now since StubDub. So we'll have to see. We don't know long term how well this is going to do well. But I will say that the Apple of where they're closed off, secretive, kind of weird developing thing, and you'll take what you can get type stuff. A lot of that was kind of Apple as the underdog when Jobs came back. And now that Apple is so large and so powerful, that I think this kind of more open behavior is much more befitting that role. And so the culture is a better fit for really their stance in the current marketplace. And so going back to the culture of languages, I want to touch on Swift. So Swift is interesting mostly from a cultural perspective. In many ways, I see Swift almost as an injection of C++'s culture into the Cocoa community. But it's not a full trade-off there. That there's a philosophy in C++ that you should only pay for what you use, and I don't see that nearly as, and maybe it's partially there in Swift, but it does not seem to be the same priority as with the C++ culture. And with Swift, it seems like you pretty much are going to get vtables for everything. I could be wrong there. There's probably some stack dispatch going on there. But I should say that I had to work on another client's project after DubDub, so I have not even... I guess I wrote one line of Swift code so far, and I have not read the books. So,
were there two bugs in it?
That's going to haunt me forever, isn't it?
It was your tweet.
So a kind of a philosophy of C++ is that you only pay for what you use. And it's kind of like strikes me as kind of a Perlish kind of there's more than one way to do things, do it type of philosophy that it's intriguing. And mostly I agree with it. I have to say I mostly disagree with Perl's kind of aspect of that. But what's interesting is that even with that kind of statement out there, which sound, maybe sounds kind of romantic, sounds kind of good, that the C++ culture like wouldn't allow them to go farther or far enough, for my respect. Even as far as they were willing to go, and even that was pushing the boundaries, is RTTI, which is runtime type identification. And they definitely didn't seem to really want to do too much of that. It was always an option that you could turn off and you make your program smaller and faster. And why would you want to turn on that option? And so I believe even to this day, you can't just walk up and easily write a C++ program where a user enters a class name for a string and you instantiate it. That's something that's beyond C++. And what's very interesting is that this is also a limitation on Swift, that there is no nth class from string, essentially, for Swift. That type of dynamicism is not built into Swift. Now, it does have the advantage that it can leverage its Objective-C side, at least leverage the Objective-C side of your application that you can do that. But there, I suspect there are significant limitations there as well. And this kind of like lack of dynamicism or not prioritizing it, I'm not surprised, because if you look at where Swift came from, it's Chris Lattner and his crew. And Chris Lattner is famous for LLVM and Clang. And guess what? Those are big C++ code bases. And it's, whereas with as Mac and iPhone programmers, we're used to building apps. We're not used to, tokenizing text streams and building up abstract syntax trees from that, and then doing code gen, right? That type of like heavy duty kind of computer science-y type stuff is probably a pretty good fit for kind of the C++ mentality. But when you're like worrying about your icon wiggling a certain way and kind of animation-y type stuff, and remember, one of the hallmarks of Clang is that it's so fast, right? And when you're kind of And there's heavy data processing loads to make all this fast. And when you're in the kind of the user experience land, you're not really like processing mass amounts of data. You're more caring about latency and making things look right than a lot of this stuff. So Objective-C wasn't always a great language for heavy data processing, but it was a pretty good language for dealing with the type of apps that most Mac and iPhone developers write. And Swift, with its injection of C++ culture, it's good for maybe people who know C++ and know Objective-C, and now we can better express these types of things. But in some ways, I'm a little bit worried that it wasn't a solution to a problem we had. And another thing is that with the lack of dynamicism and stuff like that, I'm not too worried about it. So C++ never seemed too interested in adding things that really made your applications dynamic. But this struck me because they almost like were more interested in the other aspect of the spectrum, the embedded systems type stuff, where they were throwing away features of C++ to get it onto ROMs and stuff like that. But I think that if you're going to grow a language like Swift, it's easier to add dynamicism later on. It should fit in pretty nicely, so I'm not too worried about it. And so, culture-wise, I think that we're going to experience a kind of cultural shift with how we write, how Apple developers write software with Swift. And I suspect the uptake will be pretty rapid. But I'm interested to see like how this affects like our priorities. Like I suspect like the kind of like I guess in the last episode I talked about the tidal wave of kittens of new developers and how they bring in things like CocoaPods. That's versus the graybeards who tend to be kind of much more suspicious of like adding a bunch of dependencies, which kind of goes back to kind of the web front end developer culture that I talked about having problems with, that where you have these micro libraries getting polished. And that's all you talk about. You don't care about the larger overarching application. But I suspect that the focus on overarching application, how things work, is still going to be a pretty big focus for Mac and iPhone iOS software developers. So I suspect that it's probably going to be only a good thing, that it probably will end up changing the Apple developer culture in a probably mostly a good way, that it will I've long complained that there seems to be a lack of like real software discipline, a kind of a computer science-y kind of software discipline among Apple developers, and I think it's a good injection for our culture. But I am concerned about this kind of. I almost feel like, you know, obviously Message Send and the dynamics in there. It's I hope it's not being weakened by Swift, but I think it's that kind of that small talk heritage is also a really important part of our culture that is not being addressed by Swift today, and I'm worried that our software will become more brittle. That's probably not the right word for it, but it feels like there's like a part of our culture dies with Swift as well. So it'd be interesting to see how that gets bolted on. So to wrap up, circling back to David Foster Wallace, it's really hard to examine culture in general, and especially hard to examine your own culture. But I think it helps us understand the trade-offs we make and our values and our priorities, and also allows us to take the longer view of what the successes were of various cultures, and of course also the flip side that's probably even more important, the failures of the culture. So that does it for me.
Okay. Well, I've got a bunch of notes here.
Mm-hmm.
So ahead. I don't normally write up a whole bunch of notes, so we'll see. So it was interesting, yeah, when you said, well, I'm going to talk about culture, right? Culture is a very huge thing.
Yeah.
And so, of course, we could only get to a few little pieces of it today. However, I do think that some of the things you're talking about don't feel to me like they're just cultural or even primarily cultural. So I don't really know too much about exactly the rise and fall of Perl, but I would say that kind of saying that it died because of its mantra, or even, you know, primarily because of that, or even in a majority because of that, it feels to me like a bit of a simplification. I mean, languages are used and used more and used less for lots of reasons that, you know, have to do with what APIs are sure. written in them or support them.
Yeah.
So I don't get the sense at all. I've never gotten the sense that, well, everybody just kind of decided gradually or all at once that, well, we don't want to have more than one way to do it anymore, so we're going to use a different language than that. That doesn't feel right to me as far as why. I mean, certainly discussing the merits of individual philosophies is one thing, but saying, well, Perl died because of that it seems like an overreach to me.
Okay.
I think Cappuccino, I haven't been following it because I don't use it myself. I had not realized that it was completely dead.
Oh, it's not dead.
It's not dead.
It still lives on, but yes.
But it's not. Well, so it feels to me, again, Cappuccino always felt like it was some Cocoa guys writing a web framework that worked like Cocoa does.
Right.
And so that always felt like a basically a kidney transplant, you mm-hmm. know, into the web.
Mm-hmm.
And it was foreign, and so it was rejected.
Mm-hmm.
People just said, well, that's not how we think. That's not how our culture thinks, that's not how we think. And so it was great. I think the only way it would have succeeded is if it brought in a ton of Cocoa developers to do web development. And since it didn't do that, then I don't think there was much chance for it to become a big thriving community on the web, because it's just so different.
Yeah, it's definitely different.
Although it's, you know, again, it's a great way for Cocoa developers to get into it. When you talk about what's going on with the web these days, I wonder, because it just felt for so long like, you know, the web was kind of the flagship of many operations, many companies, that they would say, well, we're going to make a great presence for our app or for our company, so we're going to make a great website.
Uh-huh.
And now it seems that so much of the focus is on mobile apps.
Yeah.
That web apps are simply, I don't know, maybe they're not the priority anymore. So maybe kind of there's all this motion happening as people try new things, but maybe that's because they're kind of cut off in a backwater now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's all they have left is to you know, they invent new things because they're not being given challenges from the outside. Oh, I don't know.
I like that take on it. That's interesting.
I mean, I know nothing about it, so this is just a surmise. But another thing, when you mentioned about Apple being maybe more playful, I mean, there might be other pieces of this to it, but I think most people are getting this kind of sense of what Apple is like from the keynote.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's 2 hours of Apple, as opposed to the years that we have been dealing with Apple.
Yes.
I think we do want to be careful, and I am it makes me a little wary that so many people appear to be judging Apple by the a 2 hour, you know, basically a show that they put on, whereas I think it's more reasonable, more useful to say, how is Apple treating us overall?
Mm-hmm.
And that just comes back to what I was saying in the last episode, which is that they really aren't treating us all that differently in most other ways.
Mm-hmm.
Apps are still being rejected for relatively arbitrary reasons, and things like that. Another side of this was, when we talk about the Apple culture, you know, you said, well, Apple culture has changed. I don't think we can just say, well, this is a cultural thing, because so much of it is based on company policy decisions.
Uh-huh.
And decisions made by the leadership uh-huh. of Apple, which is totally different than, you know, a whole bunch of people saying, well, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. So, you know, the iPhone being closed was not, well, this is our culture to make a closed platform. No, it was a specific business decision by Apple to do it. So you might say that the culture followed that,
uh-huh.
but I just don't think it's really a cultural thing at all. I think, if anything, the culture was merely, and you've talked about this before, kind of slavish devotion rather than anything else, because mm-hmm. it really, if Apple opened up, if Apple closes, if people follow them from one thing to the next, that's not saying those people really care about the way Apple does things, because they obviously don't, or they would leave when Apple changed what it does. They care about being part of that ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
which is different. So that's my take on that.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that when we talk about, well, Apple has changed, Apple's different now than they were before that, I think a lot of that, again, comes down to business decisions. Apple treated developers very differently in the beginning OS X days, because sure. they weren't as powerful.
Right.
So they opened up their platform. They said, oh, we want you to work on Java. We want you to work on Ruby. Anything you want. Come on, just come. And now that they're in power, they do things differently. Oh, no, you can only do it our way. And from what I've seen of other companies, you know, Microsoft is a lot like this as well. When Microsoft was at the height of its power, well, you do things our way.
Uh-huh.
Now that they're kind of recovering from being from falling quite a bit. You know, now they're like, oh, we're going to be open. We're going to support everything. You could say, wow, their culture has changed. Isn't that so interesting? Well, the business realities have changed. Hmm. So they adapt to do what's right for those situations. And maybe the culture follows, but it's not – the culture didn't change first. The culture changed as part of the business decisions.
Oh, I think I like your cause and effect there.
So you already mentioned how Swift came from LLVM, i.e. C++, so I agree with that. I still think, though, that it's possible to overemphasize the C++ aspects or any other aspects of LLVM. Swift is still, in my mind, very much an Apple language and very much an Objective-C language. So many of the things, when I read through the book, are, oh, they have to do it this way for compatibility with how their APIs work.
Oh, sure.
And then also, so there's that, and then that isn't cultural at all. That's, again, that's business decisions. But I also think there's so much – Apple is still thinking like an Objective-C company.
Mm.
And Swift is not a clean break with that. We discussed this before.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are overestimating how much of a break it is from what they had before, because they can't give you a clean break. They've specifically said, we're not giving you a clean break.
Sure.
And, of course, that's also due to business realities as mm-hmm. well. I'm curious about the dynamism stuff that you talked about. I think it's true that there's less dynamism. There's less freedom there. Did we ever really use it that much in our apps that we were writing? I'm not so sure.
I have. Really? I don't know what apps you're writing.
and
that's Undo Manager. I heard you did a stupid little, not stupid, a funny little tweet about it where you quoted a Duran Duran song. So I know you use NS Undo Manager. And try doing that in C++.
Well, sure, but are you creating classes as part of using the Undo Manager that don't exist anywhere in your app that are loaded dynamically?
Well,
I'm not.
Yeah, mostly not. No, right.
I think what they said was there's so many errors that have come out of a lot of this freeform, do anything you want, Wild West system, that they're like, well, we can close it down and cut down on these errors that people are complaining about, are writing bugs about, their apps are crashing because of it. If we can cut this back to the things that you actually use, then it'll be better. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's some of it. We're going to be talking about this for a long time.
Yeah.
I also think that part of the culture that I have heard about from Apple engineers and possibly also from management is that you can't go slower. So I think that was also part of Swift was that you can't just introduce a new language which is better in these five ways. It's also got to be faster than it was. Mm-hmm. And that's also a culture that came from LLVM. Their compiler always had to be faster. It couldn't just be better. So that constrains you. Mm-hmm. It says, well, we can't give you something that's totally better and new and forward-thinking. It's got to be a bit of those things, but also still faster.
And to be fair, I don't know if that's an LLVM and a Kling thing. It's like I believe Don Knowlton mentioned it. It's a debug podcast and interview, and then either before or after in his blog about how WebKit also you could never have a performance regression. Yep. So that actually might have been actually at Apple before Lattner even arrived.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And again, I think it's both. Which comes first, the company management decisions or the way people think? I think I definitely see some of this coming from management.
Okay.
In that management says this is a priority for the company. We're never going to let it be slower. Therefore, people start thinking that way and people start writing their code this way and saying these things in public forums. Mm. So that's also going to be a big part of it. And the last note was we talked about adding dynamism later on. Mm-hmm. I think adding anything later on after the language has gone through its first iteration has costs.
Sure.
Sometimes very high costs. So I think if it's not built into the language, the first thing, it's never going to be as dynamic as when, Objective-C was. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can bolt it on later and do well with that. And I'm actually a little afraid of, they said, well, we're opening up this language to everyone and we want your feedback. Well, but I don't necessarily want the language to be designed by committee, So, whereas I often take Apple to task for not taking the feedback of developers into account, in this case, I would actually rather see a coherent language that has fewer features that I like than an incoherent language which has more features that I like.
Mm-hmm. We already have C++, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think they're going to repeat the errors of C++. I think they're going to make their own. But I also, it will be interesting to see what sort of churn comes out in the next couple months. Mm-hmm. So that's it for me.
Okay, that's it for me.
Alrighty, and we'll see you next time.